The Capital Investment Committee hearing for April 5th is called to order. Members, we do not have a quorum, and so we'll move straight to some bill presentations. So today we have three boundary requests for communities that have been identified with PFAS issues in their drinking water. And then after that, we'll have a presentation from the pollution control agencies and Department of Health. And then we have a bill that I have authored after that. So before us is House File 4521. Welcome, Representative O'Driscoll. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The city of Sauk Rapids recently, as many communities have, discovered that they have some PFAS issues, and it has affected a couple of the city wells, and the city has been able to procure some funding at the local level to deal with this, and they're asking for help from the state with the bonding request of $3.6 million to help round out that. Today with me is the representative from the city engineer's office, as well as the city administrator, Ross Olson, and I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Olson to give you more background, Mr. Chair.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you for hearing us today. Again, my name is Ross Olson. I am the city administrator with the city of Sauk Rapids. With me for technical support is our city engineer, Scott Hedlund from Short Elliott Hendrickson. We also have two representatives in the audience, our community development director, Todd Schultz, and David Kruger, our SCH lobbyist, community development specialist. So I'll get right to the need. Recently, in routine testing by the Minnesota Department of Health of the Sauk Rapids water supply indicated levels of PFAS that exceeded proposed health-based values in well number 2 and approaching in well number 3. Now, since that day, EPA guidelines have come up, and when those are fully implemented, if they are both 2 and 3, wells 2 and 3 will exceed the EPA guidelines. There's some uniquenesses in Sauk Rapids in that. If you know Sauk Rapids, there's quite a bit of elevation differences. And so we have a high-pressure system and a low-pressure system. That low-pressure system serves a certain geographic portion of Sauk Rapids. The high pressure system serves the more higher areas of Sauk Rapids. That's an engineering issue. These are the two wells that serve our entire low pressure system. And so it's critically important that we address those. Multiple PFAS compounds were discovered in all additional wells, including the local aquifer, is likely contaminated with PFAS. There's some uniqueness of Sauk Rapids in that it's not easy for us just to, quote unquote, pop a well here or there. Our local aquifer along the Mississippi River is truly where not only the volume we get, but the quality of the water that we need to access. Due to health risks associated with PFAS, providing the citizens of Sauk Rapids with safe drinking water is an immediate necessity. The community has a household income far below the state average. Without bonding bill funds, undue burden is placed on these who can least afford it. The fix, as we're talking about today, to address the concerning levels of PFAS and provide residents with safe drinking water, the city's plans includes. There's three phases, but today we're talking about two. Adding three new drinking wells away from wells 2 and 3 that have the highest PFAS levels, constructing a combined well house for 4 of the city wells, and an additional raw water main to increase supply to the treatment plant. Those are the high pressure and low pressure kind of things. Modifying the existing water treatment plant capacity, and again, this project will be completed in 3 phases. We are asking for help with only 2. Phase 1, construction of a new well and booster station improvements, place wells number 2 and 3 in backup status, and that is currently underway due to the emergency of the levels of PFAS and the fact that they serve solely our low pressure system. So we had to expedite and pop a new well in, not to add to capacity in any way, shape, or form. Actually, it's going to be far less capacity, but we have to serve that low pressure system. Phase 2 is also what we're talking about today. That's the installation of 2 additional wells and possible closure of 2 wells with the highest PFAS level. Right now, we're doing what's called blending and ratcheting it back. That means just taking that on-off switch and pulling them back for wells 2 and 3. Obviously, we want to get to that point where we can shut those off and either seal them or use them only in emergency situations. We will do wellhouse reconstruction, raw water main hydraulic capacity modifications, and modifications to the existing water treatment plant. This is where our costs come of the $7.2 million where we're asking for $3.6. Phase 3 will actually be in the event that our well fields now have, if we get elevated PFAS levels. That actually puts us in the best position because now all of our wells go to our water treatment plant, which is the best place that we can send all the water, because that's where we can put that activated granular filter, the carbon filter. So it's we're construction ready. We're ready to go. And these two phases actually put the Sauk Rapids, City of Sauk Rapids, in a position that in the event that we have another issue with PFAS, we can best treat it at the water treatment plant. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, any discussions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe you mentioned this before I came in, but did Sauk Rapids opt in to the settlement, or were they an opt-out?
City Administrator.
Class action settlement?
The federal class action settlement.
The federal, we opted in to that.
Thank you.
Close the comments, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Time is valuable. We'll be on our way.
Thank you very much. Next on the agenda, House File 3395, Representative Hemson Yeager. Welcome. Please proceed.
Great. Thank you very much, Chair and Committee. I just want to say, first of all, thank you so much, Chair and Committee, for having a committee hearing dedicated to talking about PFAS. Woodbury has been long involved with PFAS. This is not really a new issue for us, really since the 3M settlement that happened. My community has been taking a comprehensive approach, looking at testing, decreasing our water usage in our community, as well as building a temporary treatment facility as we get going towards a more permanent treatment facility. And all of this kind of comes together in our bonding request for a new water tower for storage. And then I also would like to thank the committee for coming out to Woodbury to look at our temporary treatment facility for a tour and learn more about it then. So, and with that, I would really like to turn it over to my experts here and let them continue.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee and representatives, for allowing the City of Woodbury to come before you today. I'm Mary Van Milligan, Public Works Director for the City of Woodbury, and here is Jim Westerman with me, Assistant Public Works Director for the City of Woodbury. I'd like to begin by thanking Representative Hemmingson Yeager for her support and leadership in assisting the City of Woodbury on this issue. Woodbury has been focused on issues related to water for over a decade. Water conservation and protecting this natural resource has long been a top priority for the city. We've taken action to protect this resource by implementing practices such as a tiered water rate structure where people pay more as they increase their use, one of the most restrictive lawn watering policies in the state, and irrigation efficiency incentive programs have saved 143 million gallons of water annually. Water quantity remains one of our priorities. However, over time, water quality has emerged as a top issue in Woodbury due to the discovery of PFAS. The City of Woodbury is in the design phase of constructing a long-term PFAS treatment solution with the completion of a permanent water treatment plant, which is slated to start construction late this year. In the meantime, we're spending considerable time ensuring we're delivering the highest quality water possible to our residents and businesses by constructing temporary water treatment solutions to address the immediate need for treated water. While the work we've been doing to address the urgent issue has been helping due to the ongoing impacts of PFAS, we must expedite the design and construction of a $2 million water storage tower and approximately 1 mile of water main to increase distribution and storage capacity for treated water by 2025. The total cost of this project is now estimated to be around $19 million, and we have a request in for $7.5 million to assist in funding this project. The construction of this water tower will help our city meet peak water demand, with 9 of our 20 wells currently under health advisories due to PFAS and more likely to be in that situation with the new standards. It will limit the need for us to build additional interim treatment facilities while we're constructing our permanent plant, and will build resiliency in our municipal system for generations to come. Therefore, on behalf of the City of Woodbury, I humbly ask for you to pass House File 3395. An infographic of the project is in your materials. And again, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your consideration.
Thank you, Director. Members, any discussions? Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the same question, did you opt in to the federal settlement or not?
Director.
So we did opt in to the DuPont, but we are excluded from the 3M portion of the settlement.
Further discussion? Closing comments?
No, thank you very much again for your time and attention. I would just like to really commend the work of Mary and her team at the City of Woodbury. You can see the hard work they've been doing, how thoughtful they are, basing things on science to really make sure that Woodbury is a leader in the East Metro when tackling this difficult issue. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Emerson Yeager. Next on the agenda, House File 3115, Representative Hudella. Welcome, Representative. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Shane Hudella. I'm here to talk about our PFAS issue in Hastings. So as of last week, our water is now unsafe to drink. We're about a mile and a half downstream from the 3M plant in Cottage Grove, and somehow our community was not included in the 3M settlement. So where we're at today is every one of our six water towers has pollutants in it to the point that I just got my notice from the city in the mail today that our water is no longer safe to drink. It's a massive lift. It's a close to a $70 million project to put in filtration for all six of these water towers. We know that that money isn't available this year, so the city's done a great job trying to phase this over a number of years. But it's a big investment. It's a big investment for not only our constituents in Hastings, but last year the state of Minnesota invested over $70 million in a new veterans home in our community that has a 2-to-1 match by the federal government. It's a $230-some million project. And our veterans in town are going to be connecting to the same polluted water if we can't figure out a solution. So I have our mayor, Mary Fassbender, here with us today, as well as our public works director and city engineer, Ryan Stemsky, and super hopeful that we can get some help from the state. We're ready to go on the project. We want to get the first phase going, but we need a little bit of help. So with that, Mayor Fassbender.
Thank you. Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon. I'm Mayor Mary Fassbender from the City of Hastings, and I appreciate representatives for being here along with Chair Lee. As Shane has, Representative Hudella has stated, we are in a very large climb for our waters in our community. Clean and safe water is among our number one priority. Hastings' entire water supply has been compromised, which means all 23,000 of our people are feeling unsafe for drinking their water. We as the city and Public Works have done everything we can at this point, but with this huge lift and now with the new standards, it has really made it urgent for us to get to there. With that, we've all know that we've exceeded our federal law, and we would appreciate any assistance you can give. And Ryan Stemsky, our public works director, will give you some more technical.
Yeah, so the project is Ryan Stemsky, City of Hastings public works director and city engineer. The project really is identified as three decentralized PFAS and nitrate water treatment plants, and obviously the associated water main that connects those plants to our distribution system. The plants themselves include tried and true treatment methodologies, the granular activated carbon for PFAS, and ion exchange vessels for the nitrate removal. As Representative Hudella mentioned, the project has a unique feature in that we have an interconnect designed to the Hastings Veterans Home that would bring clean, safe drinking water to nearly 150 veterans and over 100 staff members. The project is shovel ready. We are currently in design and plan to be ready for construction bidding this summer. We're here not asking for temporary treatment plants, not asking for bottled water. With the recent EPA rule promulgation that happened last Wednesday, We are in a mode to deliver the full in perpetuity design. So the complete project, no temporary treatment plants. As we all can see in the handouts, it's an expensive fix at $68.9 million. This comes also with a commitment of $1 million in O&M to maintain that system long-term for the city of Hastings. And this is really a budget buster for our water rates. Our water rates would really need to be doubled in 2 years, tripled in 4 years, and that would continue as a 250% increase over the next 10 years, placing Hastings water rates atop the metro and among the highest in greater Minnesota. This would also be a threat to the city's AA plus bond rating. Putting this much capital out to bonding at the city level really would lower or would threaten that bond rating, requiring more our future infrastructure projects, all infrastructure projects, to be more expensive for the city of Hastings. And as was mentioned also, we are not currently part of the 3M settlement agreement that was established in 2018. The settlement agreement does not require a direct connection to one of the four disposal sites in Washington County, but the 2007 consent order between the state of Minnesota and 3M does require a direct connection to one of those disposal sites. Therefore, we've been working with the state and we've been working with 3M to study and review the complex hydrogeology of Hastings and the Mississippi River. Since then, there's been a couple findings. The Minnesota Geologic Survey has found and mapped fault lines that run deep under the Mississippi River and across the river into Hastings. And there has been fingerprinting from a proprietary PFAS product from 3M Cottage Grove found in one Hastings well to date. Investigation remains ongoing. The city has worked very hard the last couple years to position ourselves for this moment, for this construction-ready, shovel-ready project. We've completed our own feasibility study, ruling out all the options coming to this fix. We have dedicated the city land to stand up these treatment plants, so no delays there. We've installed some of the raw water main piping required for phase one, the first treatment plant, at a tune of about $700,000 for that project. We've established or we've obtained a grant for $3.2 million to do the design and planning work. So that's why we are in a position to be shovel ready. We're currently in design. We've also pursued all over other avenues. We put ourselves on the project priority list through the State Drinking Water Revolving Fund. We have talked with our federal legislation. We plan to submit for the community project funding that will become available later this spring. And we are committed to that $1 million annual increase in O&M to maintain these treatment plants. Just want to note in the 3M settlement agreement, if you are in that settlement agreement, right now there's 20 years of O&M provided under that settlement agreement. So just wanted to note that. Therefore, we are here today not asking for the full $68.9 million. We understand the budgets are tight at the state, just like they are at the city of Hastings, but we're here asking for $20.6 million for phase one of the project. That would stand up our first treatment plant that's shovel ready this coming summer, and it would also connect to our Hastings veteran home. That would be that part of the project too. And just wanted to mention too, if a connection is found through the 3M study and process, the state could set itself up to be reimbursed for that amount of money at that point in time. So statute allows you to do that, and I think there's been some examples of that in the past. So with that, I thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Members, any discussion? Representative Scrava.
Thank you, Chair Lee, Representative and guests. You want to phase it in. What are your other phases?
Director.
Thank you, Chair Lee. The other phases, like I said, there's three total plants required. We have six wells, and all wells have PFAS contamination in them. So we have a decentralized system requiring three treatment plants to be stood up. This would be one of three. We would put one plant in per year.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you. So is it 20.6 for each year after this, or is it going to go up and up and up?
Director.
Chair Lee, two plants would be the same, the 20.6. One would be a little bit higher because it treats three wells rather than two. So a little bit of variability, but right around that 20-plus million dollars for each phase.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair Lee. How long would it take for the state to recover its funds from statute if it is successful?
Director, to the extent that you can't cover that, if not, MPCA is presenting next. They could talk about that too.
Okay.
Chair Lee, I think I would defer that to PCA. I think the determination of the responsible party is the step that needs to be completed first.
Representative Scott, we'll make sure that the MPCA answers
that. Thank you, Chair. That's all I have.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I heard 3M settlement and the consent agreement. So the federal 3M, did you opt in? The federal DuPont, did you opt in?
Director.
Chair, great question. We opted out of the settlement agreement. The calculation was the federal settlement agreement, the class action. Because investigation is ongoing in Hastings, we didn't want to preclude ourselves from any findings, and the amount calculated at $3 to $5 million for a $68.9 million problem didn't make sense.
Chairson. And then Director, one clarifying question. So the 20.6 for phase one, is that for the entirety of phase one, or is that the share that you're asking from the state?
Chair, that's for the entirety of phase one.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, closing comments, Representative Hudela.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify a little bit, the 20.6, well, the bulk of that is state money. The city has made some significant investments already and gone out and acquired another $3-some million grant. At the end of the day, for me, this is core function of government. We've got water that's unsafe to drink in our community right now. I think there's a lot of potential for the state to get reimbursed. It sounds like the fingerprints of PFAS chemicals that have showed up in our wells now are tied to 3M. There's a little more work that needs to be done, but appreciate this committee's consideration for this. We need to get going on it and get phase one in the works so that we've got clean water.
Thank you, Representative Della. Members, next on the agenda, we have the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to come and present on their May 2023 evaluation of current alternatives and estimated cost curves for PFAS removal and destruction from municipal wastewater, biosolids, landfill leachate, and compost contact water. Welcome, Mr. Kaiser. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Scott Kaiser. I am an engineer at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Welcome, Commissioner. Please identify yourself.
Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Adelka, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Chair, would you like us to answer the questions first regarding the City of Hastings? It's a little different topic than what my colleague, he will be representing.
Yeah, if you could just answer that for the committee, and then you guys could proceed. Thank you.
So the question again, and I want to make sure I get that correct, was what would be the time frame for the state to seek cost recovery in terms of the facility? So, Mr. Chair and committee members, it is going to depend on how long it takes to find a responsible party. In these communities, we have started doing investigations, and we identified, in some cases, like the City of Hastings, multiple potential responsible parties. And so we're working from the wells or from those potential locations, taking sampling to determine who may be responsible parties. That's going to play out. As mentioned, one of those is potentially 3M, and we have them doing some of the work in addition to the agency. But it is a process that could take years, and that's why the city is before the legislature to seek funding, because they can't wait that long under the MCL, which will have a shorter time frame to move forward.
Thank you, Commissioner. Please proceed with the presentation.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. If you have any questions as I'm presenting, just let me know. So I'm here today to talk about the costs of PFAS treatment and destruction, specifically in the context of municipal wastewater. So municipal wastewater and PFAS. Municipal wastewater treatment plants, they do not produce PFAS, but they do receive wastewater that contains PFAS. So everyday people just living their lives, when they wash their coats or for whatever reason, the PFAS goes down the drain and can appear at municipal wastewater treatment plants. And so as an agency, we were interested in this question of how would you remove that PFAS from wastewater? How do you treat and destroy that PFAS, as in how do you remove it and then break those carbon fluorine bonds, both in wastewater and in the biosolids? What are the costs, and are the costs affordable? And this study was funded by the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund. So, and another notable thing about our study questions is we tried to investigate with currently available technologies, and we wanted to understand what it would take to treat PFAS to low levels or below the detection limits for PFAS. So the study is complete. We have also published the study in a peer-reviewed journal. And so here are the major study results. So in this table here, you can see some numbers. Those numbers are in millions. So what we did is a statewide estimate of what it would cost to remove PFAS from municipal wastewater treatment plants as a state. So we evaluated 283 wastewater plants, and the cost ranges we estimated is somewhere between $12 and $25 billion. So that's a lot of money. And the cost estimates are uncertain. They are wide because PFAS are new technologies and there are not established treatment methods, so we had to use a high degree of uncertainty. We also looked into what it would take to remove PFAS from municipal biosolids, and those costs range between $1.6 and $3.3 billion. And one notable thing we found was that it makes sense to regionalize the PFAS biosolids treatment destruction technologies, so our cost estimates include one large regional facility in the metro area, plus an additional 50 destruction facilities around the state. So that's those are the numbers. So those are big numbers, billions of dollars. And for context, in Minnesota right now, just to maintain the current sewer and wastewater infrastructure, there's about $5.3 billion in need. So that's non-PFAS need. That's just replacing existing infrastructure and replacing and maintaining. So why are PFAS so difficult to treat and destroy? The very properties that make them useful in everyday life also make them very bad or very difficult for engineers to design treatment systems for. They're slippery, they're used to put out fires, they can't biodegrade, they biotransform, they have low treatment targets, as in their safe levels of these compounds tend to be very low, measured in parts per trillion. And wherever you look for them, you find them. They're always in municipal wastewater. So just for some context, you can buy PFAS on the open market for somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 per pound, but we estimated it costs somewhere between $2.7 and $18 million per pound to remove and destroy PFAS from municipal wastewater. So that's a big difference, you know, a couple orders of magnitude there. So it's difficult to remove these compounds once they're out in the world. So just this is a little schematic here showing the additional technologies that would need to be added to a municipal wastewater plant to treat and destroy PFAS. So all of the green boxes there are new technologies. They involve things like, you know, high-tech filters, activated carbon vessels, and then we also included costs for destroying that activated carbon for which the PFAS sticks to. For the biosolids technologies, you would have to do additional dewatering, and then you have to apply a lot of energy to the biosolids to break those carbon fluorine bonds. And I'll talk more about those technologies in the next slides. So just for some context, to add on these new unit operations, their treatment technologies, I think it's about roughly equivalent to a complete rebuild twice over of the wastewater plant. It's adding a lot of very complicated technology. And we're still, as an engineering field, not 100% sure what technologies work. We have, you know, 100 years of, you know, sewage treatment plant design, but we have maybe 10, 20, maybe less than that, of of wastewater design for PFAS experience as a as an industry. So what do these technologies look like? You can see here some activated carbon vessels. Each one of those vessels holds 60,000 pounds of carbon. You can see a human, some people there for scale. And the main metro plant, the Pig's Eye plant down the road, would need at least 450 of these vessels to remove their PFAS. Right here, this technology right here, this is a pyrolysis gasification facility. It's basically similar to making charcoal. And this would serve a community of about 50,000 people. You can see a human there. And this is a large hazardous waste incinerator, just for they might, we might need those as well. So now the next question is, are these treatment technologies affordable? This is the figure that shows that. I'll walk you through it. What we have here are costs as a percentage of median household income. So if rates are higher than 2% of median household income, the federal EPA defines those rates as unaffordable. And broadly speaking, in Minnesota right now, rates are affordable for small, and that's the 0.1, this row, medium and large facilities. So broadly speaking, rates in Minnesota are somewhere between $30 and $40 a month for the average residents. If you add in, if you require PFAS treatment at the wastewater treatment plant, those rates would become $300 to $400 a month. So pretty clearly unaffordable. So what about PFAS in biosolids? And this is just a reminder, all municipal biosolids contains PFAS at low levels. It's just, it's expected at this point. If you don't find PFAS, there's probably something wrong with your instruments. And Minnesota produces about 160,000 dry tons of biosolids a year. And broadly speaking, we have three common disposal methods of those biosolids, either land applied, landfilled, or incinerated. And that's an incineration, a low temperature incineration that doesn't destroy the PFAS. And these methods just move the PFAS around. I will say that on the biosolids technology front, there is some promising news. Some of these technologies are really quite impressive. They can be operated greenhouse gas neutral. They can destroy all organic contaminants. They have they require less disposal, and they can have a 5 to 7 year payback, and they can even produce a kind of an activated carbon waste or product that can be saleable. So this is what the technologies look like. Mostly they just look like a sea can, like a truck can. The LCCMR did recommend funding to test this technology called supercritical water oxidation at the St. Cloud Municipal Wastewater Treatment Plant. So you might be wondering how we will use this report as an agency, and we will be using this report to focus on pollution prevention. We feel that a limits and hard enforcement approach won't get us very far, and that we should focus on finding ways to put less PFAS in wastewater. And so far that's been pretty successful. We've done some surveys. A small minority of our wastewater plants have high levels of PFAS, and we've been able to work with them to find some reductions. It's actually been a pretty promising effort, in my opinion. So I'm just going to summarize my slides here before I can take some questions. So I guess my main takeaway is that pollution prevention is much, much more effective and cost-effective than an engineered solution. That's a key takeaway. Minnesota's current wastewater infrastructure is not capable of treating and destroying PFAS. PFAS treatment and destruction technologies are technologically feasible. These technologies are possible. They're not space rocket technologies, but adapting them to wastewater treatment plants would require a lot of engineering. We know that these technologies are likely to be unaffordable for our cities in Minnesota. And we also know that regionalization of PFAS destruction technologies makes financial sense. That's a clear finding from the report. And then I'll just emphasize again that the agency is focusing on pollution prevention strategies because that is where we feel like we can get the most done. So thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Engineer, PE, what do I call you?
Yeah, you can call me Scott. I'm an engineer. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. I'll do that. I did read some of this last week when we got it, some of it. Kind of went down the rabbit hole and clicked on that and clicked on that, and it's like, I don't have the time. I mean, this is a really in-depth report. There's a lot in it. I was kind of cherry-picking, looking for information that I'm familiar with, and one of the things you were the technologies look like, you have the granular activated carbon vessels. How do you dispose of the medium once it collects the PFAS? What do you do with that? Or is the, explain it maybe a little better.
Mr. Kaiser.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Scrava. So there are a couple different ways to do it. It depends if you want to destroy the PFAS. Some of that media is just put in a regular landfill. That's not uncommon. If you want to destroy the PFAS, there are ways to regenerate the PFAS that can destroy some of it, or regenerate the media that destroys some of the PFAS as a side result. And also, not in Minnesota, but in other states, there are hazardous waste incinerators that can take that media and destroy it, and that will also destroy the PFAS.
Representative Scrava.
Thank you, Chair. And then the pyrolysis and gasification, does that destroy it, or does that just move it along? Or it does destroy it, but it's good for 50,000 people, that size of a plant.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Scrava, yes, it does destroy it, and the technology is scalable, so there's different sizes, but that technology could be scaled to a study of about 50,000 people. That's kind of the upper limit, it seems like, right now.
Representative Scrava.
Thank you, Chair Lee. The large hazardous waste incinerator, and again, I was looking for that because I was in a program earlier this year where it's at Xcel, one of the power companies has successfully burned it off, and they're yeah. trying to get that out to us. But you have the picture, and you kind of glazed over it kind of fast and went, mm. And I'm just curious, are you aware of the experiments or other states that are doing this? And are we on track to use that as far as regionalization? Because when I go back further here, you are saying, you know, maybe you don't need this in every city. Maybe you get it to a point, and then you bring it to a region and you regionalize it. So if you could help me with that. Thank you,
Kaiser.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Mr. Scrava, there's no hazardous waste incinerator in Minnesota that is capable of destroying PFAS. I believe the closest is in Illinois. It's a substantial effort to build one of these facilities. I don't, from an engineering perspective, from a permitting perspective, so I don't know what it would take to do it in Minnesota, other than I would assume it would be a big thing. I know that there are states around the country. I know Utah has a hazardous waste incinerator that can destroy PFAS. So I think, yeah, there's on a national level, from my opinion, there's not enough incinerators to go around. They're pretty full up.
Representative Scrava.
Chair Lee, thank you. But the technology is there to burn. It's at 1,000 Celsius, 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, I believe. That's the number that they, at least that report, whatever I read, I was reading down that report. Yeah.
Mr. Kaiser.
So, Mr. Chair, so the question is the technology there? And the answer is, I think the jury's still out on that. There's been a lot of research on this topic, and destroying PFAS in a hazardous waste incinerator and measuring it, I think, is more difficult than engineers thought it would be as a community. So I think we're still waiting, but I know that there are hazardous waste incinerators that can destroy the PFAS, but it is difficult to measure at a large scale.
Last follow-up, Representative Scrava, so we can move on.
Thank you. But the federal government is funding, helping offset both Illinois and Utah. with their technology of destroying to 99.9%, sorry. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Scott, I do not know whether the federal government is helping Illinois or Utah. I know that there are some private companies in those states as well that operate these technologies.
Thank you.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this is one of the most sobering presentations I've heard here. We've heard a lot on the bonding tour of magical solutions for destroying PFAS. We've heard about passing it through a series of wetlands. Can you destroy PFAS by passing it through a series of wetlands?
Mr. Kaiser.
Mr. Chair, and I do not believe that PFAS could be destroyed in a wetland. There's simply not enough energy in that wetland to break those carbon fluorine bonds.
Chair Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and can PFAS be destroyed in an open fire?
Mr. Kaiser.
Mr. Hansen, I don't think that would destroy PFAS. You know, there's a reason that PFAS is used to put out fires at airport facilities.
Chair Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and is there any permitted facility that can destroy PFAS in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Kaiser.
Mr. Hansen, no, there is not at a full scale. I think there are some test facilities in Minnesota, but not at the full scale.
Chair Hansen.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go back a couple slides to the price of PFAS? The price of PFAS, I'm glad this slide is here because we haven't seen this before. The price of PFAS is $50 to $1,000 per pound. That's a, we bought quite a bit for that. So my community is above the new limit, just like the other communities that had this. Even if we install the filters, those have to be trucked to Ohio or Illinois for quasi-destruction. Is that correct?
Mr. Kaiser.
The aggregate.
I'm not sure how the media should be disposed of for drinking water facilities. I think I would like to ask MDH about that and maybe get back to you later on that question.
Chair Hansen, the Department of Health is here to present after this too, and so they can answer that.
I think they heard it, so hopefully they can present. What guidance do we provide to facilities? Maybe that's just what guidance are we providing for drinking water systems from the state?
That is for Department of Health, but Mr. Kaiser.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hansen, I would defer to Department of Health on that as well. I don't know what that guidance should be.
Okay.
And then Mr. Kaiser, I guess I will close it up. I just have two questions. So one of your slide, I think on page 7, you have that, you know, adding this technology is roughly equivalent to a complete rebuild twice over. And so can you talk to what extent, you know, for those projects that are coming for funding right now through the project priority list, are they considering PFAS removal for future needs or whatnot? And I'm asking, you know, if they're getting funded, let's say the next few years and 5-10 years down the line, there's a need for this technology at their treatment facilities, are they going to come back yet? And so that's why I'm just trying to figure out, are they considering that right now, or what is the agencies doing to say, look, you know, this, we have a report here, there's going to be a lot of costs. Maybe we should consider these technologies now as you build out your project so that we don't see you guys 5-10 years down the line because of the need.
Mr. Chair, on the current priority list for wastewater, there is not a facility that is asking for PFAS-related funding. So I guess I don't know what cities are thinking about. I think there is one municipality that has a PFAS limit in their permit. So a lot of cities are not, they haven't had the need to develop technologies to treat PFAS. So we're, as a community, they're still kind of processing what might need to be done, but there hasn't been a lot of action taken.
And so kind of to build off of, I think, Chair Hansen's point, do we think that as an agency we should be prudent in getting this information out to these wastewater treatment facilities that, you know, down the line, even though they're not considering it now, down the line they might need this so that they build it into their projects right now so that we understand the full cost? Or do we wait when they actually come back, maybe that's 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, that we will have to fund them again at, you know, you said it here, twice over?
Mr. Chair,
and maybe,
you know, that's a big question. You know, that's kind of a policy-related question that's above my head as a technical staff. So maybe we can get back to you, or maybe Tom has something to say about that. But, yeah, that's a...
Mr. Johnson, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Johnson. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And, Mr. Chair, I'd just say we're in the process of creating drinking water quality standards for several different PFAS, and that will play out over time as in the regular regulatory process that will then move facilities down that road over time. But also, I think it's well taken that additional guidance might be necessary, as we're also working with these facilities on the pollution prevention strategies, source identification that Mr. Kaiser was referring to, and during that process it's well taken that we should provide some guidance when they're working through how to redesign their system.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And I do want to note for the record, you know, I really want to say thank you to the Pollution Control Agency and working with the legislature to get to your point around the getting to the sources of the issue. But, you know, like I have mentioned in our, you know, conversation, communities are facing this issue right now, and so I think it is important for us to work with them. And so last question is just more around the concept around the regionalization of the PFAS destruction. In your study, you looked at potentially 50 different sites. I don't know, if we were to go down that route, would that be something that the Pollution Control Agency in the state is taking a lead on, or are we looking mostly more at local regional efforts to take that on as we move forward? And maybe you or Mr. Johnson, if you guys could weigh in.
How do I want to answer that? So there's that number of 50, that's a high-level number. It's kind of thought of as like a 10,000-foot number. To make these technologies real and built is still going to require a lot of engineering. And so you can think at the 10,000-foot level, but to bring it down to like the dirt, we still need to do a lot of engineering. So I don't know. I don't think that regionalization question is fully answered yet. Like, we need to figure out the technologies first, make sure they work, and then we can figure out how regionalization might work.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for coming by to present this today. Next to the agenda, we have the Department of Health to provide an overview on PFAS and, you know, drinking water, and also just the recent EPA drinking water standards for maximum contaminant levels. Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sandeep Berman. I'm the manager of the drinking water program at the Department of Health, and with me I have Chad Kolstad, who is the supervisor of the drinking water infrastructure unit of the Department of Health. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for inviting us to present to you today about the Contaminants of Emerging Concern program at the Department of Health. Contaminants of Emerging Concern are multiple in number. Department of Health has selectively focused on some key ones that have gained national priority over the last several years, and contaminant emerging concerns are also unregulated by state and federal standards. We are going to focus on two of the CECs today in our brief presentation. One is PFAS and the other is manganese. PFAS, again, probably needs no introduction to anyone. Per- and perfluoroalkyl substances, these are a large class of human-made chemicals that are widely used and extremely persistent. They have been in manufacture and commerce and industry since the pre-World War II days. So we've had several decades of PFAS manufacture, use, and disposal in the environment. The health risks of PFAS have gotten better understood and studied over the years, and currently they are believed to cause low birth weight, immune system defects, thyroid and liver function, and kidney cancer. These are amongst the most predominant and prominent and best understood health effects. There are others that are also under study at this point. Timeline of PFAS activities in community public water supplies in Minnesota really goes back to 2006 when MDA started investigating PFAS in conjunction with MPCA, primarily in the East Metro Municipal Supplies. The next phase of PFAS was the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule. This is a federally mandated effort that happens in cycles every few years, and really the EPA's intent here is to study the occurrence of these unregulated contaminants across the nation with the intent of eventually regulating them. So these are mandatory efforts. Systems that are identified by EPA have to participate in these efforts. The next phase really was a legislatively mandated and supported project called the Unregulated Contaminants Monitoring Project, UCMP. This was an LCCMR project. Funding was granted for MDH to study the occurrence of a large number of these contaminants, which included PFAS, across the state in public water supplies. We then started in 2020 a statewide PFAS monitoring project, really with the goal of characterizing the baseline of PFAS in community public water systems across the state. With state and federal regulations evolving and the arrival of MCLs imminent, it seemed important to really understand what was the pre-existing level of PFAS in community public water supplies across the state so we could apply regulations and really start to prepare these communities for these imminent regulations, give them a few years head start. The next phase of testing for PFAS came through the next cycle in the UCMR project. This was the fifth cycle of the federal UCMR called UCMR-5. EPA greatly expanded the number of PFAS being looked for in this cycle and the number of communities that were being tested. And along with that, in 2023 also came the announcement by EPA of the draft MCLs. And finally, just last week, as you heard earlier today, EPA announced the final version of the federal rules for PFAS. First time ever there have been federal rules for PFAS referred to as the final maximum contaminant levels. So these were announced just last Wednesday. And just a brief summary, that this is a little complicated, but we have tried to explain the federal standards and do a side-by-side comparison with the state guidelines, realizing that Minnesota has had guidelines for PFAS for public water supplies for 22 years, going back to 2002, and now we have to make them work in conjunction with the federal MCLs, which are enforceable by law. These are mandatory, they're required. The state numbers were recommendations and guidance to the systems, but that's all we've had, and we've had great success and great cooperation from public water suppliers who have complied with those state guidance values. But now they have to abide by the state MCLs. So the state MCLs really are for six of the PFAS compounds. They have actual individual numbers for five of the PFAS. PFOA, PFOS are both at 4 parts per trillion. These are the most dominant of the PFAS, the most well-studied, the most well-understood. And then EPA, because EPA is looking to create these numbers at a national level, they are looking at the national occurrence of these chemicals, predominant occurrence across the nation, trying to average this out over all the 50 states and territories. So they have three more PFAS, PFHXS, GenX, commonly known as the GenX chemicals, the formal name is the HFP or dimer acid, and PFBS. So these are the additional four included in the PFAS MCL. They have an actual number for three of those at 10 parts per billion, and PFBS is getting rolled into an index. The index concept is very important because PFAS rarely occur as one compound. They usually occur in mixtures with cumulative health effects. And this concept has been very well used in Minnesota for the last 20 years. Minnesota has always had an index to go along with those individual values. The way EPA does this now, they have the five individual numbers. They also have an index. PFO and PFOS have to meet the individual numbers. The other four have to meet the index, which is a sum of the ratios of each of these with respect to their actual threshold values. EPA also, whenever they promulgate a rule for a contaminant, they also promulgate what is called the MCLG or MCL goal. This is the desired level based on health effects to the human body. And for PFO and PFOS, the MCLG is zero parts per trillion. This essentially means that there is no safe level for these PFAS in the human body. And for PFHXS, PFNA, and the GenX chemicals, they are setting the MCLG at 10, which is the same as the MCLs. The transition from MCLGs to MCLs is based on cost effectiveness and practical and technical feasibility. So in other words, how low can we treat these chemicals to? And EPA has found that 4 parts per trillion for PFOS, PFOA is where we can get this down to, even though in theory there should be none of these in the drinking water whatsoever. On the MDH guidance value side, MDH has had these numbers. They have evolved for the last 20 years. Most recently, in January of this year, MDH did revise the state guidance for both PFO and PFOS. And as you can see, these are actually lower than the MCLs now. PFOA is 0.24 parts per trillion, and PFOS is at 2.3 parts per trillion. So these have replaced earlier values just a couple months ago. The earlier values were higher than the MCLs. And then the health risk index that MDH has used is based on the 6 most common PFAS found in Minnesota. 4 of these are common, but the ones that EPA is going to regulate, 2 are not. So that adds a little added complexity to the matter of applying the state values in tandem with the federal values. I wanted to touch a little bit upon the statewide PFAS for drinking water, community public water systems. We have about 950 community public water systems in the state. We have had great participation, and over a 2-year period, 95% or 921 of these systems have participated, which means that we have been able to test the drinking water supply for 99% of the population of the state that gets their water from a community system. This is about 4.5 million people. Roughly 47% of these systems had a PFAS detection of some kind, and 19 of them, as of today, less than 2%, have results that exceed the MCLs. So we've been calculating and recalculating the MCL exceedance since the numbers came out last Wednesday. It is complex, so we're still trying to decipher what EPA has said. EPA has added some added complexity since the draft rules came out, and there are also differences in how they apply these numbers and calculate them. It has to do with things such as decimal points, and is 1.0 the same as 1.1, other things like that. So trying to very faithfully model which of these systems would actually get an MCL NOV, we are today at 19. On Wednesday when we had run this, our early interpretation, we had 22. But since then, even in this last few days, as we have looked finer at EPA's rule, we have realized that 3 of these systems would not actually get a violation because of the way EPA calculates this, which is slightly different from how the state has done it over the years. We have a PFAS dashboard that has been up and running for a few years now. This is an interactive tool for the public. Anyone can go in there and take a look at the status of PFAS testing on their community water system. They can look at the results. And we were displaying all systems that were in exceedance of the state guidance so far. We're in the process of recalibrating and recalculating. And very shortly, this dashboard will also show all the systems that exceed those MCLs. So anyone can look at which systems exceed the state guidance and the new federal regulatory numbers. This is a map of the community public water system that we're currently calculating that will exceed the federal MCLs. The other CEC, or unregulated contaminant, that has had a lot of exposure nationally in the last few years have been manganese. Manganese has significant effects on the younger population, children, and especially formula-fed infants. So there are issues associated with memory, motor skills, attention, learning, and behavioral issues in the younger population, and a significantly higher concentration, adults can have impacts as well. But the impacts on children and infants is what is of great concern as far as manganese goes. The history of manganese really goes back to another cycle of the federal required experimental testing, the UCMR process. The 4th cycle of UCMR in 2018 did require nationwide testing for manganese. 2018, MDH also promulgated a state guidance for manganese of 100 parts per billion. This was also enacted in state rule in the form of a health risk limit. And this number was really based at formula-fed children and infants. MDH's finding has been that most commercial produced formula has significantly more levels of manganese than advertised. And then when you add the manganese high in water to make the formula, you're creating an added situation where the child is getting a much higher concentration of manganese than they should. MDH has been in touch with FDA over the years, but there hasn't been much response in terms of better regulation of manganese levels in the commercially produced formula. So in response to this, and based on the fact that we had manganese data from systems across the state as part of an earlier study effort, MDH developed what was called the Manganese Response Plan, and for a two-year period, 2020-2022, we tested manganese at community systems across the state. We targeted systems that we expected or knew to have high manganese. 254 community public water systems across the state participated. 107 of these systems received advisory letters from MDH because they had exceedances of the manganese guidance. 103 of the systems took corrective actions, and 94 of the systems did notify the public of the high manganese so they could take action at the residential level. And I will turn this over to Chad Colsat so he can walk you through existing funding and proposed funding for both PFAS and manganese treatment.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee. My name is Chad Colsat. I am the supervisor of the infrastructure unit at the Department of Health. I'm just basically going to provide a refresher by presenting to this committee a few weeks ago about emerging contaminant grant funding. So first I'll touch on the existing emerging contaminant funding program. So we have currently $120 million over 5 years to use for emerging contaminants. Those projects listed for emerging contaminants need to be listed on the project priority list. They follow the drinking water revolving fund process, which works nicely. Systems are familiar with it. In order to be listed, you have to have a health risk advisory. Sandy talked about that, or director or manager Berman talked about that a little bit. And these projects typically are for treatment and wells, well relocations. Currently that funding is set up to be 50% of the eligible project costs, up to $3 million. So that's just to kind of stretch those dollars further, knowing we're going to have a lot of projects to address. As of right now, these are just a map of the existing projects for projects on the project priority list, so the Drinking Water Revolving Fund project priority list. You can see they're kind of dispersed across the state for both manganese and PFAS. And then what's proposed for future funding for emerging contaminants is to establish a new program that goes through the revolving fund process. Same process, they'll have to receive a health risk advisory. Funding would combine with the existing state and federal dollars that are available, and it would increase those caps to 80% of the project cost, up to $12 million. The benefits of going through the Drinking Water Revolving Fund, first off and foremost, is all those projects are ranked. Rather than having projects come in for special appropriations, these projects are based on public health, water quality, and financial need. So that makes us, provides us to rank our list and show what projects have the greatest need, usually those projects that are addressing public health. Projects are reviewed to ensure that they're the best project, best fit for that issue. We look at alternatives analysis to ensure that they looked at different options, and finally that they're the most cost and effective solution for the chemical. This is a program that's partnered with Public Facilities Authority, work hand in hand to make sure the state abides by the state and federal regulations so that we can continue to get those money dollars now and into the future. Water systems, as I mentioned earlier, are very comfortable with this program. It's been around for 20 plus years. Consulting engineers know how to work with the program. It just makes it simple for systems to kind of know the annual process. And again, to be on the project priority list allows systems to partner with other funding partners like USDA rural development, small cities, etc. So with that was just a quick funding overview. Sandeep and I are here to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Colstead. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Colstead. So with the project priority list, what will you be using for affordability criteria?
Mr. Kolstad.
Chair Lee, Representative Hansen. Currently, for the project priority list, we look at financial need based on median household income and then affordability rates. So we look at the existing debt service of the community, what the new debt service from the project is going to be, as well as what the O&M is going to be on that facility. So for PFAS projects in particular, the O&M is very high, as you know. So that will make a big impact, especially for smaller communities.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And will you be using median household income across the entire seven-county metro area or individual communities within the seven-county metro area?
Mr. Kolstad.
Chair Lee, Representative Hansen. We use the MHI, median household income, for the individual communities. And we look at it at a 14-county metro based on the state demographer's office, as well as a greater Minnesota average. So the metro competes with the metro, and greater Minnesota competes with greater Minnesota.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you can assure us that communities, I look at the communities here, half of them are in the metro, that they're not going to be excluded or be required to get loans instead of grants?
Mr. Kolstad.
Chair Lee, Representative Hansen. Yeah, the communities in the metro, you know, if they're on the list now, as you can see, they'll be eligible for $3 million of grant. As long as we have funding available, they should be able to get those grant funds. There's a reason why there's a cap on it, and that's allows us to get some funding to both the metro and greater Minnesota systems that are addressing emerging contaminant issues.
Chair Hansen.
Mr. Chair, we'll need a reporting requirement to make sure the public can see whether that actually happens or not.
Representative Scrappa.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Mr. Berman, you had made a comment on the existing emergency contaminants funding. Sorry. He made a comment. Where did it go? I had it here. Timeline of management, manganese activities. The manganese testing at community water systems. You had said, and this is what I wanted to clarify, there was no response from the EPA, and my thought is, well, if the EPA doesn't respond, do we not respond then either, or do we wait on the EPA to make a determination?
Mr. Mervin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my comment was in regards to the formula, the commercially available infant formula, which is required to have manganese because manganese is also an essential nutrient. And that part is regulated by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. So the part of MDH that works on those things has informed us that they have pursued the FDA on that aspect, that the FDA authorized and licensed the commercial infant formula seems to have much higher levels of manganese than on the labels. So that is the aspect that I'm informed FDA has not responded to that part of MDH. So it's not specifically an EPA issue here.
Representative Scrava.
Thank you for clarifying that. And just out of the federal funds total, $120 million for 5 years, $24 million a year at $3 million. That's 8 projects a year. Just doing the math. You have your hands. You have a handful to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all.
Members, any further discussion? See, now, thank you both so very much for coming by today.
Thank you.
All right, members, so next on the agenda is my bill, House File 5309. I will just do it from here. And so, you know, as we heard the discussion today, you know, at least from the MPCA side, you know, the cost of PFAS removal range anywhere from, like, $12 to $25 billion. And, you know, I think it is prudent for us to look at different avenues to trying to get some kind of funding to help out these communities that are being impacted right now as we move forward, knowing that the federal government should be doing more from their part. And, you know, for us at the state level, as we, you know, put together our bonding proposal, I believe that, you know, we should have other sources of revenue. And so last year in Chair Hansen's environment finance bill, we have an appropriations in there for the MPCA to work in collaboration with the MMB and Department of Revenue to look at a fee, a collection report, and see how could we, you know, get some costs from that. And so we're going beyond that. As you know, I think earlier in February, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency released their fee collection report without identifying any recommendations, without having more knowledge of what the legislature intended to do with that report. And so this bill before us, let's continue to work on that and look at how could we collect fees to provide for the cost of treating and disposing of PFAS. And so with that, that's the bill in front of us. I don't know if you all have any discussions or whatnot. And I do want to put it on the record, we're going to work with the Pollution Control Agency to work on some of the language. The intent is to look at manufacturers that uses PFAS and not just the manufacturer of PFAS. Representative Squaba.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Is there a Senate companion on this one?
The bill was sent over to the Senate to Chair Pappas. I don't know if the chair has introduced the bill in the Senate.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as the author, again, your intent of this legislation is a polluter pays model. Is that correct?
Chair Hansen, that is correct. You know, we want to make sure that, you know, if you're manufacturing this, that you have a responsibility to help pay for some of these costs of infrastructure to the public. And this is not something new, as you all may have heard in this committee, you know, last year and also in the Environment Committee that I sit on, Chair Hansen, that I have raised this as an issue for us to take a look at. And I really appreciate the MPCA doing the work last summer to work on the report that we have in front of us that was presented today to give us an idea of the cost. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair Lee. So I'm just to get a feel for this. So we're going to look at not only the manufacturers of PFAS, but also the people that use PFAS, the businesses that use PFAS. Would it be prorated on how much they use, or and if they're trying not to use it anymore, or what's the philosophy or the intent of this?
Thank you, Representative Scraba. And you know, I think to that point, those are some of the discussions point that were covered in the PFAS fee collection report that was released in February. And so I think it's good for us to have this discussion here to help shape the direction for the MPCA when, if this was passed into law, when they work on providing recommendation solutions, that they could take a look at that. Not really trying to put a fingerprint on, you know, looking at everything, or just, you know, scoping it down to certain size of the manufacturer or whatnot. And so I think that it is helpful for all of us as this move forward for us to chime in with the agency too, so that we have different options. And so, you know, we're just requiring them to come back to the legislature with recommendations for possible legislation to pursue.
Thank you.
So seeing no other questions, we'll move on to the last agenda item, just going back to the adoptions of the minutes. And then Representative Scraba, since you and I have been having a lot of conversation today, can I have you move the approval of the minutes for April 8th?
So moved, Chair Lee.
Representative Scraba, move the approval of the minutes for April 8th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for April 8th is approved. Members, that concludes our hearing for today. Our next meeting is on April 17th, and we'll continue to hear additional bills on informational basis only. The meeting is adjourned.